The one thing that really was never talked about in North Korea coverage is the culture of lying and why that is and why that lies are necessary for survival there and what that means for psychology of that nation.
For nearly 60 years, North Korea has been shuttered to the rest of the world. Few foreigners are allowed into the country, and the state heavily controls what it allows foreign reporters to see. But one journalist was able to evade this control. Welcome to The Breakthrough, the podcast from ProPublica where investigative journalists reveal how they nailed their biggest stories. I'm Annie Waldman. This week, investigative journalist Suki Kim takes us inside the hidden world of North Korea, where the head of state is known as the great leader, and absolute devotion to him is required. Suki lived there undercover as a teacher at a missionary school during the final days of Kim Jong-il's reign.
You know, my students lied all the time. I mean, basically, the great leader system is a system of lies. And if you're actually keeping people under control with so many lies, their education system is all built on lies. If you're pretending that there's no internet in this day and age, you're really covering up everything. So then their ability to discern between truth and lies become really a complicated one. You know, if you have to lie to survive, also you're encouraged to lie to survive. You also sometimes can't tell the difference. Because if you're lying all the time, are you ever taught what truth is?
But as a reporter, if the whole culture is based on lies, I mean, how do you get to the truth of it? How do you get underneath all of those layers of lies?
There's no way I can report in any meaningful way without actually being embedded in that immersive way. I mean, this particular situation was unique because they were also young. I don't think that reporting would have been as, in a way, possible to understand even remotely if they hadn't been so young. I mean, they were 19, and they were also separated from their family. So me living with them, you know, there was a level of relationship, literally, that formed that I don't think would have been possible if they actually could have gone home to their mom and dad, whom they would have possibly opened up more to. Or if it wasn't such a vulnerable time, this was when their regime was obviously changing. It was all new environment for them as well. So I think this set of elements made them vulnerable. So months and months of us living together were when some things were said that I felt that even them admitting that they missed their girlfriends was not something that they all lied and said they didn't have any girlfriend over and over and over because they only served their great leader. It took months before they would even say things like that. And because I knew them so well by then, you know, you eat meals with them three times a day. You do get beyond all the lies. There is a humanity that is actually just people relating to each other level. So I knew when they were telling truth and lies.
Suki says it was inevitable she'd be interested in North Korea. She grew up in South Korea, and the Korean War split her family. Most of her relatives made it to safety, but her uncle was kidnapped by North Korean soldiers and never seen again. The story of Suki's family is not unique. Many families were torn apart by the war, and then kept apart by an invisible border that divided the North from the South. In 2008, Harper's Magazine sent Suki to cover an unusual event. The New York Philharmonic was playing a concert in the capital of North Korea, Pyongyang.
줄곧게 감상하세요.
The event was celebrated as a critical moment of diplomacy, but Suki thought it was a setup.
These are incredibly smart journalists, and they can only write what they are being shown. What they're being shown is this really bright city that looks great and electricity flowing. I believe it was February and it was like hot in all the hotel rooms. It's not like journalists don't know this is a put on or, you know, even that concert. I think both the Times and CNN reported like audience was all moved to tears. I mean, I didn't see anybody crying. And if I did, like one or two, and some of them were actually South Korean, they were, you know, they who were VIP who were invited there. Why was this somehow reported as this moment of diplomacy?
During her trip to cover the New York Philharmonic, Suki was introduced to a wealthy Korean woman from Brazil. The woman was funding a new university in Pyongyang. It was to be run by Christian missionaries with only foreign teachers. Tsuki found it hard to believe, but she still submitted an application. She was interviewed and she waited. Then one day, she got the phone call.
When I was finally told, like, come and pack the bag, you're going in, hardly any information was given to me, which is surprising for someone to go live in Pyongyang to be told nothing. I was told to bring butter, and I didn't even question. That's another thing I think that when you do this kind of work, you just don't ask a lot of questions because any step of the way, they could get suspicious. So I just ask almost zero question. And when they told me to pack butter, I packed butter.
Were you afraid that you might not blend in with the rest of the missionaries that were going?
Every step of the way, because, you know, I've never been religious and I've never done anything. I'm just not a religious person. So I was more worried that they're going to find out or, like, quiz me. You know, say something about the Bible that I wouldn't understand was more my concern.
Along with butter, Tsuki brought a handful of USB sticks to store her notes. She didn't bring any recording devices because she knew if they were discovered, she could be killed. In Pyongyang, Tsuki was greeted by a government employee whose job it was to follow her. He took her passport, cell phone, and then she got on a bus to the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology. Almost all of the school's concrete buildings were connected by an enclosed glass walkway. The campus was impressive, which was fitting for the students that attended the school.
The students were the sons of elite. Now I believe there are women there a little bit, but in that year, it was only men. They were all sons of elite. You know, if you were to film them, they look like you can imagine them walking around Manhattan. I mean, they're so well-fed and obviously beautiful, too, because all their parents are probably Miss North Korea and the party leaders. So it's actually literally the creme de la creme of North Korea.
Most of Tsuki's students were from the capital and had powerful parents. They were obedient and stuck to a strict schedule. Marching and exercises in the morning, courses all day, gardening or sports in the evenings. They also had daily obligations, washing the Great Leader monument that sat in the middle of campus, studying the Great Leader's political philosophy, Juche, and singing.
They're constantly singing songs about the Great Leader. And, you know, Without You, There Is No Us, which became my title of the book, is actually a song that they sang all the time.
Do you remember the song?
Yeah.
Can you sing it?
I mean, it's like, it's so familiar in my mind. It's like, 당신이 없으면 우리도 없다.
There were certain topics that you couldn't talk about with your students, one of them being the internet. But also there were certain ways that you couldn't even discuss things about the outside world.
The censorship was basically everything. I mean, the level of censorship is basically minders live in the same building, and their job literally was to watch over me 24/7 because we all lived in this locked campus. You know, obviously, all the lesson plans are being recorded and reported on. Every conversation is being reported and reported on. I was given a list of things to not talk about, and it was basically everything. I mean, if it's a school of science and technology and they don't know what the internet is, then that means there's, like, nothing I can talk about. If you realize it's all being reported on and there's minders taking notes of what you're saying, out of a survival mode, you just get into a way of not saying anything. But then this is where it gets complicated. You then live with this young man and you want to tell them things. You know, it is so heartbreaking to see so clearly how little they know. So you would like to share that information with them. But then you become more and more aware of the consequences. Because if I make them curious about the outside world, I mean, it's just so simple as if they ask how many television channels are there, because they only have one television channel in North Korea that really works. They have three officially, but they only really have one. You know, if they were to say, how many channels do you have? Even that's an answer that I have to hesitate before answering, because there's a different levels. How can I explain there's hundreds of channels while they have one? How can I explain those hundreds of channels don't really play all Great Leader stuff? Because every single program of theirs plays only Great Leader stuff. Would they really understand why we have all these choices? So something as little as that then became a tremendous problem, but also responsibility and fear. You know, I was afraid of causing some horrific future for him. And this was every second of being in North Korea.
And part of that is the surveillance state that exists there, right? What is it like to live under such surveillance?
It's remarkable how quickly you get used to it. I think that is what is amazing about human nature. Because you can't really do anything. It's a police state. So you go in there and minders take you everywhere and they take away, you know, you don't have your phone. So connection is just no longer possible. Or movement is not possible because you have to get a permission. And they decide what you're going to see. So I think this way of living is really basically abuse, right? The abuser has every power and you have no power. Then that system is actually not that complicated one. You just follow the order. Because if you don't, something horrific will happen to you. I mean, I guess that's the whole evil is banal thing. I mean, it really is, because you really do just do. And I think it also then explains the way my students lived. Sure, they're elite, but why do we assume they enjoy all the privilege that elites of the outside world might enjoy? They were completely censored in every single way. They hadn't seen anything. They hadn't gone anywhere. I mean, it was very clear when you live with them, how much they know. Even if they say they do know, you know, you have a few more conversations, they have no idea. You know, they all told me they knew what the internet was, but then they would ask me things like, I mean, they wouldn't even ask me, it'll slip. They'll be like, oh, so how many movies can you watch on your internet? Clearly they don't know. I mean, it's this kind of stuff that would reveal very quickly that they don't know or have.
Were you afraid that you would be found out as a journalist at any time?
All the time. I think that was a fear every second. I mean, there's a reason why no inside reporting that is not censored by the government gets out. Sometimes I would think that way, sitting in that room, my dormitory room. Clearly I'm writing and look like I'm doing school lessons, but if there were a camera in the room, which I would have not been surprised if there had been, how would they know? And I would think, how would they not know that I had pages and pages of notes? And so it was this kind of thing going, circling in my mind. Like, are they trapping me actually? You know, like, I mean, I think the fear of this being caught and what would happen after that. I mean, that it was a really bleak scenario.
What did you think would happen to you if you were caught?
Well, I mean, definitely it would have been against their national security. And I guess punishment for that would have been, I don't know. I mean, obviously, a gulag sentence would be, you know, very obvious one. But depending on the political situation, you know, I went through all those scenarios in my mind that would Bill Clinton come and get me the way he went to get other people? But this is a little different because I am actually caught with hundreds of pages of notes, which they could consider completely like a spying work. This is far more serious, right? So, I think that's when I would usually stop myself from thinking further because I don't know if I would be brought back to America.
Was there a moment that you thought you were almost going to be caught or convinced your cover was blown?
I mean, I think the minders keep slipping. Little things to me were always worrying because, you know, we were taken on this great leader outing, great leader trips, meaning like go see some great leader monuments, which is basically every monument in North Korea. And a lot of them, you would have to leave your bag in a locker or something or back in the car because you can't bring anything in. And those moments, I just was always afraid what he's going to look through, which he would. So I think those moments, I was almost certain that my covers were blown. And also among missionaries, because, I mean, there's a double angle to this, which obviously those missionaries catching on would definitely get me sent home. You know, I didn't think they would report me to the North Korean authority, but I knew they would kick me out. And that was always also very stressful because I had to do this worship. You know, I don't know any of those terms that you need to pray. So that was real challenge. Like, I remember always just hiding my face. Like, I would have my hair down right in my face so they wouldn't really see that I was just mumbling words. And one time I was basically, I thought pretty much my cover was blown because one of them told me not to take the wine and bread if I didn't believe those were Jesus's flesh and blood. I mean, I really kind of broke down, I think, when she told me why she was there, which was to bring she judged North Korea because she said it's not really about this world, but their next world. I mean, that's a very conventional, fundamental religious belief, but I never really obviously said anything that was on my mind. But when she said this is not real, because the real world is waiting for them in heaven, I really lost it. I mean, I kind of like raised my voice. I was like, you go check out a gulag and you tell me that is not real. And I quickly regretted it. I couldn't sleep all night after that conversation.
What was the reaction?
She looked at me like kind of horrified, and I knew I had now just messed up. Because clearly what I just said would reveal me not to be like a missionary. So I just said, I really, 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 really don't feel well. So I need to walk away. And then I went to my room petrified. And I was so certain she's going to report on me. And I skipped the service. I think that following day was like Sunday or something. And I had to go to the service. And I pretended to be sick because she was next door to my room. So I coughed all night so she could. She knew that I was too sick to attend the service. It's like I'm just trying to cover my track. But amazingly, what I learned after that was that the next door neighbor, she thought that I just wasn't as devout as her. Like, I think she just thought my faith needs to be better. Like, my faith wasn't good enough. I think that is kind of where she stopped herself. I don't think it would have occurred to her that I was actually not even Christian.
The teachers were under constant surveillance, but the school would take them on excursions with their minders in tow. They were taken to a Christian church, but Suki believed a large congregation was made up of actors. They were taken to an exhibition hall that supposedly housed over 200,000 gifts to the great leader. Again, Suki doubted that this was true. They were also taken to an apple orchard 30 minutes outside of the city. Suki found out after her visit that it was her students who planted the seemingly endless rows of apple trees. They didn't return to the orchard after they planted it, and they have never tasted the apples.
I mean, when you leave the school itself, basically what you get is their setup, you know. I mean, church service or election booth. I mean, these are not real election booths, and obviously there's no freedom of religion. So church is kind of people kind of pretending to be Christians. But when I went to the apple orchard, you know, one of the teachers had to use the bathroom, and I said, I need to go too, just to see what was outside. You know, this whole apple orchard was all about these lectures about the great leader, the times he came to see these orchards. I mean, it went on and on. So I kind of thought if I at least went to the bathroom with this woman, then I could at least see what's down below the hill of the apple orchard. And three minders came with us. While we were waiting in line, this old woman actually just peeked out of her house. This is her bathroom that the teacher was using. And she did say, where do you girls come from in Korean? And this woman was so old. And I was so shocked because locals never speak to you. They're not allowed to. So I said, hi. And then that's all I got to. I mean, the minder basically shouted at the woman in Korean to, like, just get away. And the woman just, like, immediately shut the door. And I think that moment was one of the only moments that was not in the script. And because this was not in the script, they panicked. And the way the minder ordered her, this really old woman, in such a frightening way, you know, in the Korean culture also, you don't speak to old people that way. So, I mean, that's the kind of a moment I think that it's nothing to do with the facade of what we get seen, which is what they usually show you. Beneath that is this fear.
One striking moment of your story was when your American colleague showed up at the school. What was it like to see this American journalist walking around the school that you had been living at for so long?
My heart totally sank when I saw him. I knew he was trying to get in to report on the school, and he knew that I was there undercover. But I was just afraid he might slip up and kind of say hi or something. But of course he knew, so he didn't do that. But it was really nerve-wracking because at first, you know, I think that it's as if by then, you know, I'd spent all these months isolated in there with my students. And I think I felt afraid of the outside world coming in. And yet, at the same time, I also wanted to talk to him, but I knew I couldn't. And I think I also felt afraid he's gonna maybe trap my students. So I think it was a moment of vulnerability where I wasn't, you know, clearly I'm like him. I'm an American journalist, but my loyalty was really with my students. I was worried for them. If any of my students were to slip up and ended up in his article, it's gonna be a big trouble. And I think that's what worried me most. And I wish that my students wouldn't so readily talk to him.
Do you think that over the course of your reporting and being there that maybe you had changed in some way?
I think so. I think my worry for them became a more personal one. I got to know them so well living there, and I just worried for their sake.
Your last day in the country was a very dramatic day, not only for you, but also for your students in the entire country. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened before you left?
So my students had been so heartbroken that I'm leaving, that I might not come back. They can't really say things, I'm going to see you again, or like, what's your email address? None of those things are possible. So what's so horrible is that because they have no agency, they have no power, the only thing they can do is like, we'll come and say goodbye to your teacher tomorrow, knowing very well they can't. You know, they have no individual time. They can't walk over. It's the next building, their dormitory to my dormitory, but they can't really walk over individually to say goodbye. And I think repeating it enough, it's almost like a child. It's very infantilizing, because if you say it enough, maybe it's going to happen. It's all a little bit like that. And I knew why they were repeating things over and over and over, because it was the only way they can express their feelings.
It was on this emotional day when students were called in for an assembly and told that their great leader, Kim Jong-il, had died.
We were told that there would be some sort of a tribute for him in the great leader study hall, that if any of the missionaries were inclined, we could go pay our respect. Nobody went, but I went. And that's when I saw some students that were not my students, and their eyes were swollen. Next morning, I went to breakfast. My car was leaving, but I actually went just to see them. And I saw them in the cafeteria. And this is where I, you know, ate every meals with them. And I knew I couldn't sit amongst them now. They had just completely checked out. Like, they saw me, but they didn't see me. Like, their faces didn't change. So I sat on the other side and just watched them. And I just watched them, trying to make eye contact. But they didn't look back. And that was it. That was how I left.
You came back to the States with hundreds of pages of notes. I mean, where do you even begin at that point and putting it together and making a book?
In the beginning, it was really hard to leave North Korea to this now the world of access. You know, it's like free everything, energy or electricity or so much stuff. This is a world of stuff. I kind of just didn't leave the house for a few months. And then I think slowly I started sifting that into a book.
Suki expected her book would be celebrated, but instead, she says critics fixated on the fact that she taught at the school under false pretense.
I was really surprised when the immediate reaction was real focus on deception, that I lied to get in. It's as if they thought that I was like outing all these Christians who are doing grassroots work in North Korea. That's not true. It's actually this organization that had been collaborating with the Kim Jong-il regime for a long time. You know, so it's not like I was outing anybody. The regime, North Korea, knew very well that this was a missionary organization. So what was I outing? But I think it gave people this impression that I lied and then like put everybody in danger, none of which is true. You know, I mean, it is the first ever account of an undercover amongst North Koreans. Why this information that actually documents the final year of Kim Jong-il's life was dismissed? Like, I thought that would have been the focus of any reviews or discussion about the book. But the focus went elsewhere.
Without You, There Is No Us became a New York Times bestseller. The story was told from Suki's perspective, in the tradition of literary journalism No details or personal feelings were omitted. Batsuki's story was billed as a memoir, not investigative journalism.
People didn't quite understand, like, why does journalism have this personal aspect? But that's the literary journalism part. I think we've had plenty of books that have done this, you know, where they take a personal view and put, you know, whether it's Norman Mailer or Joan Didion or even Hunter Thompson, you know, he like smoked dope for the weekend. I'm not trying to downplay what he did, but it's not a memoir, or at least wasn't judged that way. It's all sorts of reasons. Obviously, there's sexism and there's racism and there's Orientalism all combined. The real expert books on this topic are by white people, and memoirs are by North Korean defectors. So here I am, actually Korean, Asian. They couldn't really look at me as the expert opinion book. You know, and I still get attacked where they say this is just not investigative. And I don't know where they back up that claim, except somehow they cannot see me as one, cannot see me as having done investigative work. And it's really illogical and irrational what that response is. So then I think journalists all basically want to do this Inside of North Korea story. I think I'm not a conventional journalist belonging to any respectful organization. Then somehow I think I did it. And I think it kind of pissed everyone off on some level. So I think there's a territorial thing that somehow I was in their territory where they could all be okay about it as long as no one did it. And then somebody did it and she's not really even a conventional reporter. I think it pissed everyone off.
Do you think if it was a white male investigative journalist that the reception would have been different?
I think it would have been absolutely different. I think I was met with such suspicion. It's kind of remarkable. Why? I don't think that male reporters get that kind of reception. I mean, the evidence is right there. There is no such reception for male reporters' work undercover. In fact, they get hailed for heroism. I never talk about how dangerous it really was or how scared I was for my life because it becomes my heroism, I thought, in the book. So I never actually do blatantly talk about that stuff. It was always subtle. But for me, that was a literary choice. But I think maybe in public, in interviews or whatever, after your work is now out there, you are supposed to talk about that. I still feel uncomfortable about that. I don't know why we have to constantly, but I think having watched the way men talk about their work, I think they are far more less subtle about the risks they took. And why we have to do that as women, I don't even know if I'm still able to do that, of like, because I feel like it's self-congratulating me in a way that's not really necessary. But I think it's because we are just met with skepticism. We just are. I don't know what. I guess that's what sexism is. They don't trust you for some reason, and they don't want to give you the credit you deserve.
Though Suki was disappointed by the reception to her book, she was indeed the first American journalist to successfully go undercover in North Korea. The book she wrote about it, Without You There Is No Us, has amplified what we know about the sheltered state and its people. Next week on The Breakthrough.
There were these woods out there, and the thought did cross my mind at the time, is he watching us? So it was a bit of an unnerving moment when she started tossing out the machetes and swords.
Machetes and swords, and Jerry Mitchell's intrepid investigation that led to the prosecution of a suspected serial killer. That's next week. You've been listening to The Breakthrough, the podcast from ProPublica where investigative journalists reveal how they nailed their biggest stories. Our theme music was composed by me, Roland Tony. Our producer is Kate Brown. Tim Kramer is our engineer. Ibi Caputo edited this episode. Celeste LeCompte is our executive producer. And I'm Annie Waldman. Thanks for listening.